yay, oh yay, oh yay. All persons having business before the Honorable United States Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save this honorable court, and please be seated. Case number 03-3102, United States of America versus Melvin B.
Good morning. May it please the court. Beverly Dyer on behalf of Melvin Brown. Melvin Brown's pre-sentence report listed 10 arrests. The only information detailed in the report about the arrests was that the details of the offense are unavailable. Each of those arrests was dismissed or no papered, and there is no information about why the arrests were dismissed, the charges were dismissed or no papered. That's it. That is the only record before the district court regarding any prior offenses for which Mr. Brown was not convicted. This information is no more incriminating than Mr. Brown's hair color or his address.
So you don't put much weight in Judge Bates' footnote 2 at the end, that he says, although Brown argues that arrest records are not sufficiently reliable, he does not directly challenge the accuracy of the arrest records in this case. He neither disputes he was arrested or that he engaged in the conduct underlying.
I don't believe that Mr. Brown had any reason to dispute that he was arrested, because the arrests are not themselves material to a sentence, a longer sentence or a lower sentence. Mm-hmm. I do believe the district court could consider the arrests as part of Mr. Brown's background, just as the court can consider all kinds of facts about Mr. Brown's life.
Okay, well, what burden do you think you have to contest the underlying conduct?
Had there been a statement connected with each of these arrests that Mr. Brown committed specific conduct at a particular time and place, and there was something specific about an offense, in that case, under Pinnock, which I believe should be reconsidered in light of Mitchell, but under this court's decision in Pinnock, we would have had an obligation to say that that did not happen or to dispute that. I believe that a dispute should only require us to state that the government needs to prove that conduct through submission of reliable evidence that we can then contest or contradict or impeach a witness or, you know, have some basis on which to dispute. But this court has held that we are actually required to step up and say that it didn't happen. Had that happened, had the PSR, and this is a good example, because the government submitted the case of Chavez Calderon in a 28J letter. In that case, there were facts of the offense that were in the pre-sentence report, and the court held, just as this court has held in Pinnock, that the defendant did not dispute those facts, and that therefore the court could consider the arrests, could consider the conduct. But the court did not hold that the district court could consider merely the fact of an arrest alone, without any even statement about underlying conduct. Here, we don't even have a sentence saying that Mr. Brown was found in a vehicle, he was not authorized to drive, for example, or that he was found on a particular street corner with drugs with a particular person. We don't know what we know is that a police officer at some point in time thought that there was probable cause to arrest. But that police officer might have changed her mind. A magistrate or a prosecutor might have found that there was not probable cause. There might have been a mistaken identity. Mr. Brown might have been...
I agree with you on all those propositions, I think.
Thank you.
Can we go back to a sort of background question, that is whether we're talking about plain error or harmless error?
Yes.
Now, you point out that the government said itself that arrest shouldn't be taken into account, but the sequence at sentencing, as I read it, is first the judge says he's probably made mistakes along the way, and so he'll give counsel a chance at the end to correct his mistakes. Then he uses the language that you criticize in the sentencing, clearly putting weight on the arrests. And then, as promised, after that exercise, he invites counsel to state objections, and defense counsel has no objection.
And counsel does not state objections. I understand that this court, and I don't have the case at my fingertips, has held that in those circumstances, counsel has an obligation to object to a sentencing finding. I believe it's very difficult for counsel to stand up after the sentence has been imposed. I do believe this court has held that I think it's difficult for counsel to get up after a sentence has actually been imposed and object to the terms of the sentence. Here, counsel, before sentencing, had no reason to bring up the arrests at all because the government had dropped a footnote saying that the court should not consider the arrests.
I don't know. I mean, I guess if the judge invites objections, I'm not sure why it would be hard for defense counsel to respond to the invitation.
Well, here the defense counsel did not, and if to the extent that that is the standard, and this court does not believe that this case is before the court now on both the Coles remand and the original sentencing.
Right.
So both of those procedures are now in front of the court. This case is very different from Thompson.
But then, I mean, the Coles remand is for a narrow purpose and doesn't itself, at least, I guess the district court could possibly, well, I'm not sure
but
it certainly doesn't in itself reopen this aspect.
I disagree because I think Booker reopens this aspect. And I think this court in its decisions in Coles and Henry has basically acknowledged that a court's consideration of a sentence within the guidelines is very different from the court's consideration of a sentence within a statutory range. And for that reason, there is incentive under Booker to raise arguments. There was a new applicable law at the time of the Coles remand, and that was not present in Thompson and in a number of other cases.
Yeah. And how is that related to Booker?
Excuse me?
How is that related to Booker?
Well, I think that it opens up the possibilities for the district court judge, who now has a reason to consider more a wider range of sentences and to think more fully about all of the factors that might go into the sentencing decision. And for that reason, I think there was incentive for counsel to raise arguments that might not have been raised, that could conceivably have been raised at the original sentencing to argue for a lower sentence within the guideline range, but perhaps were not. And then were raised after Booker to argue for a sentence lower than the guideline minimum or the bottom of the guideline range. I think that this court's decision in Coles and Henry that, for example, a sentence just over the bottom of the guideline range did not demonstrate that had the court been presented with all of the arguments relative to sentencing, it might not have gone down, because it didn't go down, say, by 3 months to go to the bottom of the guideline range, that looking at the range of sentences applicable under the guidelines, under mandatory guidelines, in the range of sentences applicable under advisory guidelines are two very different prospects, leading counsel to have an incentive to raise more arguments than might have been raised at the original sentencing. And I think Henry confirmed that understanding of the difference between a district court's considerations before and after Booker.
Let me ask you about, I mean, he was very careful, Judge Bates, on remand to go back to 3553A and say, and here are some things that I consider in addition, statutory considerations, and did each one of those.
That's correct, but had Judge Bates really not considered the arrests to be significant, I think he would have stated in his order and in his memorandum opinion on remand, I think he would have said, I find that there are plenty of other reasons here to arrive at a 96-month sentence. I do not need to consider the arrests. They are not relevant in my view. Instead, he said, I'm rejecting the defendant's arguments that the arrests should not be relevant. And I think that because he explicitly declined to clarify to the court that the arrests were not significant to the sentence, that we know that the arrests were, in fact, significant to the sentence. That has to be the conclusion of him rejecting that argument explicitly. So
I'm not sure I understand your argument, because I thought you were saying on remand, not only do you look at the what you looked at before, but you look at 3553, which he did, but are you saying even if you do that, if you view something that we think is wrong,
I think our argument is fundamentally that increasing the sentence or increasing the severity of punishment based solely on an arrest record with no evidence of underlying conduct or even allegation of underlying conduct is improper under 3553A. So it is
okay,
that
he
that
didn't
it's
do
a
that here. He didn't do it wasn't solely the arrest record.
No, I don't think that that's the standard. I think the standard is, did it affect the sentence? Did his consideration of the arrest record have an impact on the sentence that he chose? Did he choose a sentence of 96 months in part based on the arrest record?
All right.
Had he not considered the arrest record, would the sentence conceivably have been lower?
Okay.
That's my understanding of the standard. If the court has no further questions, I'll reserve my remaining time for rebuttal.
All right, thank you. Ms. Barlotta?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Allison Barlotta on behalf of the United States. I'd like to focus on the trial court's consideration of appellant's prior arrests, where my opponent has focused her argument today. The trial court properly considered the appellant's history of 10 arrests within a 10-year period as one factor among many in selecting an appropriate sentence within the guidelines range. Once a court has calculated the applicable guidelines range, it is given broad discretion in imposing a sentence somewhere within that range. Here, the sentencing court's decision was based on undisputed facts in the pre-sentence report. And although there was no underlying information about the facts underlying those arrests, the court drew the conclusion that that this mere pattern of behavior was indicative of the appellant's background, character, and conduct. And both 18 U.S.C. Section 3661 and 1B1.4 of the sentencing guidelines instruct that no limitations shall be placed on such information. So certainly the court's consideration of this pattern of conduct was within its discretion in deciding where within the applicable guidelines range to impose a sentence.
Well, pattern of conduct, I mean, actually, as appellant's counsel mentioned, it's really the conduct of various police officers. Now, not acting in a vacuum, presumably, but it is acting. The only thing that's proven conclusively, at any rate, is their conduct, right?
Well, certainly here we have a pattern of 10 arrests, subsequent to which all of those charges were dismissed. In addition to that, the appellant had three convictions, two as a juvenile and one as an adult. But what the court looked at here was the fact that this was a person who, from the age of 10 until the age of 20, had been in contact with the criminal justice system a total of 13 times. And even though no convictions resulted from the 10 mere arrests, the fact that this person had put himself in a situation where he had attracted the attention of law enforcement authorities 10 times within 10 years, certainly the court can draw some inference from those facts. And again, the facts were undisputed.
The inference is that he's arrest prone.
That's correct.
So, I mean, it's really a theory that where there's smoke, there must be fire.
Well,
right? Or at least where there's a lot of smoke, there must be some fire.
In comparing, the court could consider appellant's history of arrests for a couple of reasons. And I suppose one inference is that this person is engaging in, at the very least, some sort of questionable conduct that's attracting the attention of law enforcement. But, you know, if the court is trying to determine what is the appropriate sentence for this individual, then certainly the court must sort of see how this person compares to someone else. And if, for example, the court had before it two defendants, and one was 22 years old and had no history of prior arrests, he was being arrested and charged and convicted for the first time, had never been in contact with the law before, certainly that would permit the inference that this may be an anomalous event in that person's life, that it was perhaps a mistaken judgment. That
maybe it just means he wasn't arrested for his past conduct.
It may, but when you have a person who is
why is one more likely than the other?
Well, when you have a person who at 22 years old,
can't arrest everybody who commits crimes.
Well, certainly someone who has been arrested 13 times by the age of 22 and for two of those years was incarcerated, there is some inference that can be drawn. And at the very least, we know that this is someone who has been involved in the criminal justice system, who understands that there are serious consequences for certain behavior, but nevertheless made a conscious decision to commit a crime, at least on this occasion. So certainly the court could view that person somewhat more harshly than a person who has not been arrested before. As I said, the fact that there were 10 arrests, and in fact a total of 13 arrests over a 12-year period, really I think it informs the court as to this person's character and background. Now, is it a factor to...
Why don't we draw an inference from the 10 dismissals? I mean, If we knew, for instance, that the same policeman arrested him these 10 times and he just, you know, had it out for this fella and they were just, I mean, shouldn't we draw some inference from the fact that they're all dismissed or papered?
Well, we don't have any information as to why these charges were dismissed, what reason that might be.
I know, but you're talking about inferences. So we can draw an inference about his contact with the law enforcement people for 10 years, but we can't draw an inference that nothing ever came of it.
Perhaps we can, we could, I don't know what the inference would be that, that nothing ever came of it. If, as in your hypothetical, there was some evidence that one police officer had arrested this person over and over.
One may be that he didn't do it.
One may be that he didn't do it. But again, at least, at the very least, this person has been engaged in some sort of conduct that he's been in contact with law enforcement over that period of time. And, you know, the court made clear that it was not basing its sentencing decision on the fact of defendant's 10 prior arrests alone. The court also looked at the seriousness of the crime of conviction, his lengthy criminal record, his actual convictions.
But it was a factor.
It was one factor that right. the court considered. And again, the court has broad discretion to consider many factors about the defendant's history and characteristics in trying to assess what would be an appropriate sentence for that defendant and to serve the interests of the criminal justice system. Arrests are something that the courts have looked at prior to the sentencing guidelines, subsequent to Booker. As counsel pointed out, I submitted a case last week from the Tenth Circuit where the court did consider the defendant's prior arrests as one factor relevant to the defendant's background and character. And certainly we believe that would be appropriate here.
Are you arguing your case this way today because you think we're reviewing for harmless error?
We would submit that the issue should be reviewed under a plain error standard because it was raised for the first time in the Coles remand. And the purpose of a Coles remand is really very narrow. The court is only directed to determine whether it would have imposed a different sentence post-Booker had the guidelines not been mandatory. And Judge Bates certainly made clear in his written opinion, in his written order, that he intended would have imposed at the very least the same sentence. And so, I'm sorry, to answer your question, we believe that a plain error standard applies because this objection was not raised at the original sentencing. If the court has no further questions, we would ask that the judgment of the district court be affirmed.
Why don't you take a minute?
If I could take 10 seconds. First, there was no conduct even in the PSR specified. The government's argument is entirely based on a propensity type of argument, but there was not even an allegation of conduct except by police officers. And even if this court, we strongly object to the application of plain error review, but even as this court did review for plain error, it would be clearly plain to sentence somebody based on non-existent evidence, based on an unreliable source of evidence, based on...
sentenced on the basis of evidence of arrests. The question, I think, is what inferences can reasonably be drawn from those undisputed facts. It's not a question of sentencing on no evidence.
Well, it's a question of sentencing based on police officer conduct where we don't know why the police officer conduct was, why a prosecutor or a magistrate or the police officer, him or herself, walked away from that conduct. And we do know that they did, in fact, walk away. Some of those allegations of arrests were for serious conduct for which the government would typically prosecute if they had evidence. And I think that it is clearly plain to sentence somebody based on essentially no reliable source of evidence, certainly by a preponderance of the evidence, that they committed wrongful or illegal conduct. I think that would be plain error.
There are lots of bases for sentencing that don't have anything to do with actually committing additional crimes.
But here, the judge lumped these together with convictions and clearly treated them as wrongful conduct, illegal conduct. The judge treated these, if they are allegations of arrests, let's put it that way, because we don't even know what the source of the arrest record was that the PSR writer used. We don't know. Now, that wasn't disputed, so... I understand this court can take the arrests as listed in the PSR as fact. We don't know where those came from. They may have come from a Wales printout. The Supreme Court's decision in Shepard says that even if we had a PD 163 detailing what the police officers saw, that's not reliable evidence to support a finding by a preponderance of the evidence. That's the basis on which we would submit that this error was plain. Thank you very much.
All right, thank you.